Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Okay, guys, welcome. We hope you enjoyed Surfiel's interview of me.
Oh, yeah.
That I actually posted up today. And John is nodding his head. But we're going to interrupt that right now because I'm still preparing these excellent questions that I'm going to ask Surfiel next week. But this week, we have John Brooks and Kelly Baker from the Pod Only Knows podcast. And John was with us back in April, and he did an excellent presentation that is on our Patreon site that if you're a $10 and up Patreon, you can get to right now if you really, really want to. But it was very excellent. So, John, welcome back to Conspiranormal. And Kelly, welcome to Conspiranormal. First time guest.
Thanks for having us back. Yeah. Or having John back.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want you to know that John, like, completely cold emailed me out of the blue. I get emails sometimes, always like, who is this person? Like, come on. No idea who this is. And I read it and I was like immediately intrigued. I was like, yes, that is a topic that I want to cover. And so I emailed him back, I think after a couple of days, and had him on, and that was a excellent episode that we did. And through that, he told me about your podcast, Pod Only Knows. And now it's a pretty regular podcast that I've been listening to with you guys.
Oh,
I think
awesome.
You guys are
awesome. Thank you.
I think guys are posting like twice a week. Is that correct?
Once every 2 weeks. And then we do at least once a month, a little Saturday fun topic episode that the two of us just talk about something that is on our mind or interests us that we call the Saturday chit chat episode.
I was going to wait for it. You have to call it the chit chat episode. That's what it's called.
Yeah. So three times a month. And that's pretty much kind of what we've been doing lately as well. But I'm pretty impressed by the podcast. I really like it. I enjoy it. You guys got some good chemistry. But let's talk a little bit about John and Kelly, what motivated you guys to do this podcast. And John, we should also say that if no one has heard the interview that you and I did a few months ago, that you actually have been podcasting for a while, but you've now kind of shifted gears and changed names of your podcast. So we'll talk a little bit about that history as well.
Yeah. Kelly, you want to explain why we're doing
I think you should tell the history of Hard to Believe first, and then we can talk about Pod Only Knows. I think we have to do chronology here. Sorry, bud.
Well, as I was mentioning, like right before we started recording, I inadvertently started Hard to Believe right when the pandemic started. I did not know there was going to be a pandemic, and did not mean for those two things to intersect. So, yeah, I mean, I'd done some like I did a podcast with my friend Joey Lewandowski like years and years and years ago. We had no idea what we were doing. It was a lot of fun. Somebody else like edited and produced it for us and everything. And like then I had kids. Right. And so, yeah, after a while, I sort of wanted to have a space to talk to some of the people that I found really interesting and explore the kind of space of like religion and the supernatural, kind of like, I mean, Adam, sort of, you know, your inspiration for doing this podcast as well, right? Like mostly it was a selfish way to like get free books and talk to people I think are cool.
For sure.
But I also kind of like, I wanted to expand the sort of definition of what religious studies is, and really dig into like the way that beliefs kind of show up in different ways, right, within culture, both like popular and otherwise. So that, you know, led me to like things about conspiracy theories and urban legends and religion and everything kind of in that space. So Kelly and I first talked like a few years ago. We have people sort of in the same circles, I think, like a lot of the people that she kind of like follows and knows, the people that I kind of follow and know. And then somehow like, I mean, I'd known Kelly's work beforehand. And so she was a guest on my show. We're both Leos. We both have a very similar.
Yeah, it's some big Leo energy on the show. It doesn't take long.
Well, I'm a Leo as well.
yeah. Amazing.
So Surfiel is surrounded right now. So
sorry, Surfiel.
He's not a Leo.
You guys got all the attention for sure.
I really apologize. So yeah, I mean, sort of over the last, I don't know, year or so. I just was feeling a lot of burnout, and I do another podcast. It's totally different sort of, it's a movie podcast. It's a totally different realm and it's a lot of fun. But I really learned how much easier it is to work like with somebody else, on something. And I kind of like, I knew that Kelly had sort of flirted with the idea of starting a podcast for a long time. You know, we'd appeared together on a couple different things, and I was just like, I kind of want to refocus more towards like religious studies. And so I emailed her in like the winter, and I was like, I kind of want to transition into a two-person podcast. Do you want to do it with me? So I don't know what was going through Kelly's head at the time. She can pick that part up, but that's how that happened.
Yeah, no, I'd wanted to get into the kind of podcast sphere for a while. I just wasn't sure how to approach that. And I knew I wanted it to be about what my PhD is in, and that's where I've put a lot of professional capacity, but I wanted to do it more in a kind of casual space. I didn't want it to be academic-y. I didn't want to just talk to other academics, because I've done that already. I wanted to talk to a larger audience, and I wanted to do it in a way that was more chit-chatty and more engaging, and that people could learn a lot, but could do it in a way where it's fun and we laugh a lot and we have a good time, so that it could be serious, but it could also be irreverent at times too. So when John reached out to me, I was like, sure, why not? Like, what do I have to lose? Like, I could be a podcast host. Why not? Right? Like, how hard can it be? It's a lot harder than it seems. But like at the moment, I thought, sure, why don't we do this? And like John said, he and I have kind of been circling each other in these different arenas for a while. And the couple times that I was on Hard to Believe, which was his previous show, and then I actually was even on the 99, which is his other podcast that he mentioned, was a lot of fun. And we were able to sort of talk with each other, and I thought it really worked out. So with Pod Only Knows, we kind of wanted to take the great stuff about Hard to Believe, this talking about religion, talking about it in a fun way, but also a serious way, and bring in religious scholars and kind of make them play in the same sandbox with us, right? Which kind of takes them out of what they're used to doing in a lot of ways, that they're not necessarily hip to this in the ways that maybe they should be, but it gets them to talk about their work for a larger audience and tell us about why it's relevant and why we should care about it and what's going on right now that we should really be paying attention to. So it's a lot of fun actually to kind of get them in a different arena than what they're used to, and to get them to deal with both of us too, which I'm not sure they're entirely prepared for either. I kind of feel like I should apologize ahead of time, where I should be like, we're both a lot.
They love it.
Yeah, but we're a lot. Yeah. You know, that's also true. Those two things can be true at the same time. Yeah. So I think that's kind of what we try to do, is to talk about religion, but to talk about it in smart and funny ways, and to just get a bigger audience thinking about this, and maybe in ways that they haven't before, and try to be as engaging about that as possible, instead of really kind of in a way that, you know, shuts down conversations. Instead, we want to start them.
getting stuff out of the silo of academia and into more popular framework.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the space, like the religious podcast space is very strange, because the majority of it, like 90% of it, right, is like evangelical Christian sort of, you know, like praise podcasts or like, you know, prosperity gospel sort of stuff. And then there's like the people who take either like a very, and I love some of them. I listen to some of them, but there's the ones that like, you know, take a very specific topic in religious history or studies and sort of dive deep into that. And that's great. But there's just not a lot for sort of taking a sort of broader, you know, perspective on it and doing so in a way that is not super duper, you know, we're serious people, but like, and we, you know, we talk about serious things seriously, but I think both of us as sort of people who are in this religious studies world, but also kind of outsiders to religion, right, have that sort of, that sort of perspective of like knowing how to like what angles get people interested and into it. And I think that's really important. And it's, you know, I just feel like the podcast, saturated as it is with like everything, really has a need for that space.
Yeah. So you guys are conversational. Kind of
we really try to be conversational, and try to make sure that, that's what we're doing is a conversation, that we don't want someone that's monologuing, right? That we don't want somebody that's lecturing to us. that's not what the moment should be for our guests, right? That we want them to sort of be moving along with us and talking with us and not talking at us. And we don't want to be talking at them either. So that it's like my favorite time, because we just have really fun conversations, really smart conversations with people who were really interesting and are doing really cool work. And like one of our running jokes is that before every episode, I'm like, I'm so excited today because of this person. And I think I say that before every episode. And there hasn't been an episode where I haven't said it, because I'm just like genuinely like hyped that we get to talk to these people every single time. And I have no chill. Yeah. So I'm not able to like tone it down in any way yet. Maybe that's someday, but I doubt it.
Don't lose it.
Can we talk a little bit about your background in religious studies? So this is kind of a two-part question. It's going to lead to my next question, but I know John a little bit. Is there a particular area in religious studies that you focus on specifically, or is it more general? I mean, what interests you the most?
So I actually have a PhD in American religious history. So my training is in our religions in America, kind of more broadly. I am interested in the 20th century. I am pretty much focused on the contemporary. What tends to interest me the most is, I think, stuff that would make most people uncomfortable. So my work tends to be on religious intolerance, religious violence, apocalypticism, occasionally zombies, often hate groups, that kind of stuff. So all the really, really pleasant topics in religious studies is what I tend to work on. I don't know that excited is the right word, but that tends to be where the bulk of my research is. I'm also just kind of generally interested in the kind of stories that people tell about religion and how they narrate these stories, like what's going on with how we put together the religious worlds and the kind of stories that we tell about them. But that's like high level nerdiness on my behalf there. So, all right, John.
Yeah.
You dodged
yeah,
it.
And, and I think it's interesting because a lot of the stuff that like Kelly is really sort of an expert on is kind of foreign to me and vice versa. So like I'll talk about some verse in the Bible and she'll be like, what the hell are you talking, you know.
I don't know.
Kelly's not a biblical scholar. And I'm not either, but like that's more my avenue. So, you know, my study in college, my undergraduate was like mostly in religious history, sort of global history. And you know, I in theology and the philosophy of religion and that sort of thing as well. So, you know, I'm coming more from sort of like the internal guts of religion, whereas like Kelly is someone who sort of understands more of like the way that it operates, right? Like in, especially in the modern world and this affected sort of modern events. And like there's certainly a lot of overlap, like certainly some of that stuff is, you know, mm-hmm. things that I've studied as well, but we definitely have kind of different perspectives on what we studied when it comes to religion, which is like really helpful actually, because
yeah, I was gonna say it sounds like both of those really complement each other.
They do. yeah so that's real handy. But like yeah, we had one of Kelly's friends as a guest to talk about you know, ancient magic and
oh my goodness,
and it yeah. was great. And then like she and I started talking about this one excerpt from the Gospel of Mark, and she's like, "What are you like? Why does Jesus yell at a tree?" And I'm like, "Oh no, it's great. It's this part where he just starts magic."
But it is one of those things where every once in a while John will be like, "You know this story from the Bible," and I'm like, "No, actually, yeah, I don't. No, like, yeah. time out. Like, we have to wheelhouse. Go through this. This is not what I do, friend."
I'm gonna buy Kelly one of those illustrated children's Bibles so she can catch up.
Oh my goodness, yeah. It would be amazing. It'll be my reference text for the podcast, where I'll be like, "Hold, please, while I flip through this."
I remember this picture. There it is.
You can find the whole King James Version on Spotify if you really look. It's there.
That's true.
With all the these and thous.
You can go to Bible.com and you can literally have it read to you in any version. Like it's pretty cool. They have an audio file for every single translation of the Bible, which is pretty handy. That's free. Or not.
Or I could let John explain things to me
Literally, that's why I'm here.
So Kelly, you're more interested in how religion affects the modern world and especially 20th century America.
I am. And I was trained as a historian. So you know, so much of my work is thinking about historical narrative. It's thinking about timing. It's thinking about what people are doing in particular times and places. You know, I used to tease my students who would come to me and they'd be like, "The Bible says," and I'm like, "The Bible doesn't talk," right? Like, and then I would like move along, right? Not to like entirely discount them, but also because like, I don't really deal with biblical texts. Mm-hmm. I deal with historical actors who talk about it, you know, but it's not really like what I do. But you're exactly right. It's not entirely what I'm interested in at all. And so it is interesting when John is able to do this, where he's like, "Oh, you know this story," and I'm like, "I vaguely know this story."
You're concerned of the influence that it has. That
I am has right. Yeah.
On the modern world and on modern American society.
Yeah.
And John is much more looking at the historical, looking at the ancient. Because, you know, the way John heard of this show was because we had interviewed the guy from History in the Bible.
Okay.
And that's how he heard of us. And that's really, really interesting. As an aside, I wanted to ask you both a thought that just came to me. In your professional lives, teaching, do you have to be careful about some of the things that you talk about with your students? I mean, how does that manifest? And I think, John, you teach secondary, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like Kelly doesn't teach anymore, at least not right now. It is a very tricky field to teach in, just kind of in general. Like, I don't think it really matters what level you're teaching at. You can teach religion basically in two different ways, right? There's, you know, nuns telling you what to believe, etc., right? Or there's you know, teaching about religions and teaching sort of the world religions, right? Sort of perspective. And I am very upfront with my students will sometimes ask me like what I believe, and I will tell them like I'm not, A, there's no good answer to that, and B, like I'm not going to get into it because that's a conflict of interest kind of, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's an incredibly tricky thing to teach, and you know, it's like, Adam, I think we kind of talked about this when I was on with you last time. It's sort of like there's no other field where someone's perspective on it is like the basis for their entire life, right?
Right.
And so like that makes it just something that is, it's just difficult to teach. But I think that's also like part of, if you studied religious studies academically, it's something that you kind of learn, like, you know, just sort of like through your professors and like the way that they teach things, you kind of learn how to approach it that way. But like, yeah, I've gotten angry emails from parents before. Sure. Like, I mean, not regularly, and like not as regularly as you might think, but sure. Yeah. It happens. It is something where you're going to, no matter what you say, right, you are going to upset someone's impression of it, especially because even with something like Christianity, like the way that Christianity exists in modern America is so varied that like no two people are going to have the same Christianity. So, you know, to me, it's always about like not proselytizing, which is easy for me to do because I have nothing to proselytize about, right? Like, I just don't. And it is about sort of, you know, challenging people to like question their assumptions and all that sort of thing. But I will say that like the feedback that I've gotten over the years from students, especially students like who are students of faith, have always told me when they feel inclined to do so, that my class has like strengthened their understanding of their faith. And like that is really like, I don't care. I'm not there to do that, but I'm glad that like that is the response. Right. Like that's reassuring, because that's certainly what I would like prefer, right? Or even someone who's like happy to be like, now I'm an atheist. I'm like, great. I'm like, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, if that's something that you're happy with and you came to on your own, then it's very cool. But yeah, I mean, it's a minefield, but it's a minefield even in podcasting about it, right? Like, just ask anybody with a religion podcast. You are going to get angry comments. Yeah.
I'm waiting for my in-laws to discover our podcast and then be the ones writing in about this to us, about how they
one
feel
star.
About this. One star. Yes. How dare she?
Shelley, I mean, as a professor, as a teacher, have you run across the same thing that John is talking about?
Yeah. No, I think, you know, I taught primarily at colleges and universities. And so I didn't deal with high school students like John was dealing with. I dealt with college students who, you know, who could be really sensitive about this in the same way that John is talking about, because religion could be the centerpiece of how they understood their lives. And so I took that very seriously. At the same time that I taught classes on religious hatred in the United States, so that we were dealing with religious people often at their worst. And so that could be really hard for students to process, where they don't want to think of religion in this way, right? That they want to assume, because they find religion good, that religion is inherently good, or they want to assume that some religion is inherently bad. And I would throw something at them where I'm like, you know, religion is what people do with it. And then they would not know what to do entirely with something like that. But yeah, it would often be really hard and very tricky. And that was before the current political climate. So I can't imagine trying to teach where I live now in Florida, some of the classes that I used to teach, where religion and racial hatred in the United States in Florida, right? Like, I don't know that I would be able to teach a class like that now, in the same way that I used to teach it, years ago. But yeah, it was always one of these like balancing act that you had to have, where you're trying to get through that subject matter, trying to present this stuff while also trying to keep at least the forefront of your mind that, this stuff matters a lot, and that we have to, or at least I did. I felt like I had to be very respectful of that and to think through what it meant about how I put together things and how I approached it. And, you know, podcast Kelly, who's a little more irreverent, was not classroom Kelly generally. you know, it was a different kind of space there, about how I handle myself. Right. different mm-hmm. with students. But yeah, it was, I mean, it's a different world now, I would say, for collegiate teaching of religious studies, especially depending on what state you're in, that it's gotten a lot hairier and a lot more difficult, depending on who your governor is.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine what it's like. I mean, it was bad enough, I think, for teachers on like the secondary level, you know, with COVID and the pandemic, having to make all those adaptations. And now it's just, and I'm sure this falls definitely within your field, Kelly, that the real kind of right wing just upsurge in the, you know, especially in your state with the list of banned books.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine what it's like for teachers now.
No, I mean, there's a reason there's a chronic teacher shortage, right, in Florida, and that they're still trying to find teachers, and school starts in a few weeks, right? Then they can't find folks for classrooms. It's shocking, really. It's not shocking, but you know, that they're very much shocked by it.
Even in the, like, you know, sapphire blue Northeast where I live, right, it definitely has gotten, you know, has gotten worse. And like, I have begun to notice the encroachment, like the empowerment and kind of entitlement that sometimes, you know, parents feel to just go straight to the teacher and just like call them out, which never used to happen before. But like, you know, I'm lucky that I work in an institution where, like, you know, attendance is voluntary. I don't have a state apparatus breathing down my neck, and I have a very like supportive administration who you know, generally takes the side of the teacher first. Like, that's their instinct, and that's really great. But like, I, you know, last or 2 years ago, I got an email from an angry email from a parent for discussing Karl Marx in a way that was not openly hostile. Like, you know, like, it's that sort of thing, right? And like, that would never ever happen before a couple of years ago. It just wouldn't.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like,
just a little bit important to history in general,
to history and religion, and like the history of the church in the 20th century.
Just a tiny bit, though.
I didn't start by saying Karl Marx is an evil mastermind who destroyed, you know, like, and that's, I think, was, you know, and I was like, actually, here's some observations that he made, and you can decide what you want about like what they are. But that is a bridge too far for some parents these days. So yeah, it sucks. And there's, I mean, there definitely have been times, again, even in my fairly sort of isolated and privileged position that I'm in, where I've like been like, I'm quitting today, like I can't do this anymore. So I can't even begin to imagine what it's like for public school teachers in certain southern states,
just elsewhere. Teach out of the John Birch Society curriculum.
Oh, fuck.
That brings me to the second part of the question. Topics that you cover on the show, how does your religious studies background, how does that give you a unique outlook as opposed to like us? We're not trained in religious studies. I mean, like, you know, I guess both of us kind of doubt, but having those degrees and being immersed in it and having written some of the things that you guys have written, how does that give you an advantage to look at the topics that you've covered on the show? And I guess you could include hard even that too, not necessarily just
part. Because I think that a lot of the show and the guests you guys have on is really about the pulse of spirituality in the world and of the times, because it's not static at all. And we're living in an especially vibrant time with all these permutations of mainstream and fringe religions.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll start. So I mean, a couple of the episodes we've done have been like straightforward with like religious studies people. We, I think, are both interested in sort of picking apart more kind of relevant, modern, contextual parts of that, right? So like when we talk about, you know, the history of like white supremacy and yoga and that sort of thing, and like, you know, we could do a podcast about yoga practice, like that's something you could do. But, you know, I think we also both have maybe me a little bit more so than Kelly, but I know Kelly to some degree, like an understanding of like basic tenets of Hinduism and that sort of thing, right?
Right.
Where we can sort of kind of skip that part, right? And get to just sort of like, you know, get through the basics and then talk about what's interesting. But then also, yeah, I mean, like a few of our other guests, you know, like Mike Rothschild and like Toby Ball, like when we talk about anti-Semitism and sort of the anti-Semitic conspiracy trope and you know, I think kind of bring our understanding of like Judaism sort of into that. Or with Toby, you know, it's something where he has been doing this amazing podcast about the history of sort of the UFO phenomenon for the last 3 years. And, you know, Kelly, especially like the way that, you know, that those kinds of sort of cultural phenomena have sort of spilled over into the American religious landscape. Right. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like when we talk about what guests we want and what topics we want to cover, like when we talked about The Last of Us, like we did a whole conversation about that. I think both of us are like, I like the religion angle about this thing. So like, let's just talk about it.
Right.
And sort of like shove the religion fork into it. And like,
yeah. Yeah. Seeing like how that informs part. Whatever the topic is.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the way that we've approached most of these, is that the religion angle is what guides us, right? So that it's one of those where we can both watch The Last of Us, but also get to a certain point in that show and be like, wait, did you notice this part, right? Did you see this? Like, we have to talk about this, right? Because of these sorts of things that happened in this. So it's one of those where I feel like that training in religious studies means that we are like honed to find religion in unexpected places sometimes. And we're also a little bit ready to have conversations that aren't the 101 conversations, right? So John mentioned the conversation about yoga. So that conversation with Srina Gandhi, which was a great conversation, was not Hinduism 101, right? It wasn't us going through and sort of explaining that. Instead, it was like a hard-hitting conversation that covered things from like yoga and white supremacy to caste. And it very much was because we already have some of that background. Mm-hmm. And so we're not there to do the 101 piece, which other podcasts are doing and doing really well. But that's not necessarily the kind of conversations that we want to have in some kind of way, right? We're trying to do something that's a little bit, I don't want to say elevated, because I don't like the way it feels, but I'm going to say elevated.
Well, I would say so.
Yeah. You guys can't see my face, or maybe you can, but like, it's one of those where I was cringing. Like, maybe like this really cringy look, but yeah, no, it's something that's just, I was going to say a step up, but that makes me like feel cringy too. So I'm just going to stop talking now.
I think also that like, as our history as teachers, like one of the things that we also are sort of cognizant of is that, like, you don't necessarily have to understand sort of everything that we're talking about, but I definitely like want it to be interesting to literally anybody who's listening. And so I think that we're both kind of sensitive to when we are both kind of aware that like, this is something that probably people don't know, that we try and give a little bit more context to that.
That's right.
But also like, we're just not, you know, we're not interested. Like, you don't have to know anything, I think, going into listening to our podcast. And I think that if you learn more about it, you'll probably get more out of it. And if you want to, then great. And if you're inspired to, then great. But like, trying to find that balance of like not having to like hold someone's hand through this topic, but then also sort of like talk about things that they can relate to. Like, everybody knows like what yoga looks like in America. And so like having a voice of someone who can speak to the kind of cultural history of that, right, is like, that's your entry point. And I think we're always kind of looking for people who are familiar with like popular culture, just broadly speaking.
It is that. It really is. We definitely have a pop culture side to what we're doing that's a part of this, and a politics piece that's very clearly.
That's true.
Because like, in popular culture and politics, especially right now and in the media landscape and everything, just like ideology is underlying in so many things, but a lot of people don't understand the ideological underpinnings of so much stuff. Same with what you guys are looking at, the impact of belief systems and these things
right.
that are behind so much stuff that is decontextualized and people don't really understand what's at the root of.
Yeah, I can understand what you guys are saying, and that you don't feel that you need to give a whole thing about Hinduism 101, because if you did, I mean, you would spend the entire podcast just explaining that.
Right.
And we're the same way. I mean, people have to know when they listen to this show, they have to know what we're talking about. So, for instance, this thing on my shirt, the Flatwoods Monster.
Yep.
If I reference the Flatwoods Monster, I'm not going to explain everything that happened.
Sorry.
The Flatwoods Monster. I'm going to just say the Flatwoods Monster. That was a weird thing, and it might mean this, and it might mean that. So, I totally get that. We're the same way, is that you have to come to Conspiranormal with a little bit of knowledge. And I feel this,
and I don't think anyone's going to come to your show and be like, "Oh, what's a conspiracy?" Like,
right.
I've been meaning to check out what this whole like conspiracy theory paranormal thing is all about. I think I'll check out this. They'll explain.
It does happen occasionally.
I'm sure it does. I'm sure. Yeah. But
yeah. We can talk about that. And actually, I want to get into this with you, John, and also feel free, Kelly, because I feel like this is also kind of in your purview as well as being a more modern thing. You know, when I had John on back in April, we talked a little bit about, because he said something in his email that intrigued me about how conspiracy theory, which is something that, you know, Serviel and I talk a lot about, and we talk a lot about the nuances of it, and we talk about what that word means. He said something to me that said that it was really influenced by Christianity. And when I really sat down and thought about it, I thought, yeah, that's right. And we expounded a little bit about that. And then we talked about the Jesus mythicism. And John, I want to get your thoughts on that, of how this conspiracy theory narrative that we see, especially in the United States, because yes, this is still a predominantly Christian nation, how that conspiracy theory narrative is heavily influenced by. And we should say that, Kelly, I think you've written a book kind of about this. So feel free to chime in on that.
Yeah. So it's funny because, so I was listening to your interview that Serviel did with you this afternoon. And a lot of your path has been like very, very similar to my own. Like I was listening to like sort of the way that you talked about the different sort of phases of your life, right? And the way that your relationship with religion kind of panned out and all that sort of thing. And like there were certain stops along the way, and I was like, oh, that's me. Oh, that's me. And then like you would go in like a slightly different direction than me, but then like, you know, we'd sort of come back to very similar places. Like we were both talking about like listening to Bell around the same time, right? And for the same reason that we were like both working overnight and that's what was on. And so I found it really interesting, like the way that you talked about your own experience with religion, and that like you seem to sort of instinctively understand that there is a relationship, especially with Christianity and sort of this conspiracist mindset, right? And how there is some overlap there. But, you know, I think that in terms of the way that the history of different sort of conspiracy movements and different conspiracy theories, for lack of a better term, over the course of Western history really traces back to Christianity, and that a lot of, when you look at something like a QAnon, that a lot of it's, or even as we talked about with Toby Ball, sort of the sort of UFO hysteria movement, right? That there's a lot of echoes of very particularly like Christian style religion there. And a lot of it is quite logical, because when you think about sort of where Christianity was born, it was born at a in a sort of soup of religious fervor and new ways of thinking, and trying to address a insurmountable problem that was like nonstop oppression and sort of like the you know, the giant looming thumb of the Roman Empire, right? Mm-hmm. And what it presented was very much like the definition of a conspiracy theory. Yeah. It said, the reason this is all happening is because Jesus is about to show up, and it's all God's plan, and God planned this whole thing for this one event, this apocalyptic event that's going to change everything and bring about the New Jerusalem and everything else. And so, in fact, like, God is conspiring to make this happen, and that's the explanation for it, right? Think about that in terms of like QAnon the storm, and it's exactly, you just kind of swap out some words and you have exactly the same thing. And, you know, I also think that, again, Adam, like, what was really interesting about your conversation was the way that you were talking about sort of like these different narratives and sort of views really like shift the way that you understand everything else, right? There's a cascading effect between like when you think there is an afterlife and there is a all-powerful God, right? It changes everything about the way that you see the world. And I think a lot of, you know, when people fall into sort of like conspiracy theory rabbit holes, right, it does the same thing. It really changes your perception of everything, and everything has to fit into that space. And I also think like one thing that's always been a kind of uniquely funny about Christianity, right, is the way that Christianity defines God, and Christianity is this religion that created a monotheistic religion that was intolerant of other religions, that was, you had to exclusively worship this one God. And that, of course, creates a bunch of problems, right? Because then you have to explain a lot of stuff that does and doesn't happen and why it doesn't happen. I was thinking about this today because I think one of the really interesting sort of phenomenons, like one of the things that's happened over the last several years is the immersion of something called Stuanon. And I don't know if you guys know what that is. I'm happy to explain it to you if you don't. Do you know who Jim Stewartson is?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so Jim Stewartson.
Yeah.
All right. So Jim Stewartson is a deranged lunatic who has bullied and doxxed a bunch of my friends. And he is a conspiracy theorist who believes that Mike Flynn is the person who's behind literally like everything bad that's ever happened and all of QAnon. He has come to this conclusion through exactly the same ways that QAnon believers have come to their conclusions. And his sort of cult that's emerged out of this has all the same trappings, right, of QAnon. And what I think is really interesting about it is that the way that Jim Stewartson sort of presents Mike Flynn is exactly the same way that, like, right-wing conspiracists talk about the New World Order, or the way that Christians talk about God, which is the person behind everything is at once all powerful and has no limits and just is a mastermind that can do anything, and also hopelessly incompetent at the same time. Right. So for Jim Stewartson, like, Mike Flynn is both this criminal mastermind who is behind this insurrection against the United States and must be arrested immediately and nothing else matters, and also this like bumbling buffoon who Jim Stewartson caught red-handed. Right. The New World Order is all like, you listen to Alex Jones and it's like the New World Order is doing this and this and this, and they've got us and we're dead and it's over, and like, you know, and they're 10 years behind and they're never going to catch us and we're winning now. And it's like, with God, it's like, here's this guy who can create universes and also like destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, but like not prevent gay marriage or whatever, right? You have to pray for that because he doesn't know what he's doing and needs your help. It's, you know, it's,
well, he
it's,
does it's, send the hurricanes, Don. He sends the hurricanes.
He sends the hurricanes, but like can't stop kids from getting slaughtered by AR-15s in elementary schools, right? Like, that's just something that's beyond God's power somehow. So there's this kind
of, he's busy with the hurricanes.
He's busy with, yeah, sure. It's interesting because I think that the monotheistic God of Christianity, right, sort of trains the mind to think of power in this way. And even if you're not religious, then being sort of, you know, sort of, I want to say, like, you know, conditioned, right, to think in that way, makes it much easier for you to believe the inherent contradiction at the center of conspiracy theories, which is that there is this incredibly powerful group who's controlling all of world events and can do anything, but they also just, like, really bumbled this whole pandemic thing. They, like, were trying to kill everybody, but they screwed it up somehow. And it's like, well, which is it, right? it seems like an inherent contradiction. So I just, like, you don't see this same system of thinking, like, pre-Christianity, and you don't see it in, like, non-Christian religions. And also, there's no other world religion that really started as a cosmic conspiracy theory, right? It just didn't. Like, Islam is close, but even Islam's genesis is quite different. It's not apocalyptic the way that Christianity was, right? And certainly, like, you know, Buddhism is not, right?
Real quick, Adam, I want to say, like, I think that has a lot to do with the relationship to the state, like you had mentioned, and to this occupying force.
Yeah.
You know, that this cosmic conspiracy, the worldly powers are actually, you know, in league with these supernatural forces of darkness. And so I think it primes our culture, who's inherited all this, to build these meta narratives around the worldly powers being part of the satanic conspiracy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, one of the big things, and, you know, I did not say this in the last episode, but one of the big things that was always quoted among these fringe Christian groups that would talk about Nephilim, and they would talk about aliens being demons and all these type of things, alien abduction being a demonic thing. They would always, I think, Ephesians 5, the armor of God, for we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against princes and principalities in the heavenly realms.
A favorite of Ron DeSantis. Yeah.
Right. That is, you know, and that's exactly what Serville is talking about. I mean, you know, it has a tinge of Gnosticism that you are against the Archons.
Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, that's definitely it. And the point that I was going to make is that there is a melodrama to Christianity. There is a ultimate good. There is an ultimate evil, and they fight each other. And, you know, I mean, you can go back to Zoroastrianism for that, right?
Yeah.
But that is one of the things that is very prevalent. And you're right with, like, somebody like Jim Stewartson, who I find his stuff very interesting. But I do see that, like, I think Flynn has some major influence.
Oh, Flynn sucks. Like, and, like, he definitely does. Right?
Yeah, I don't think that he is, like, the complete mastermind. He's probably more of an opportunist than he is a mastermind.
Yeah.
But he is a psychological warfare officer. He does know what he's doing in that respect. But,
right.
But this is the thing, though, about conspiracy theory, and this is where I fall in, is that conspiracy theory is basically good against evil. It is the good. It is us against the bad people that are influenced by the people in the heavenly realm. And the big thing for me that really kind of changed my mind was the quote by Alan Moore, where he said that conspiracy theorists don't want to think about the fact that no one's in control, that it's just chaos.
There
you've
it
got
is.
All yeah. these you've got all these different groups against each other. And also, conspiracy theory too, I mean, as we've talked about on the show, has been used as a propaganda tool, and it's used as propaganda warfare now, essentially.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom. noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Yeah. 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 And look, to the point about Flynn, and I think this is also, I'm glad you said that, because this is a really important point as well, right? Early Christians were right that Rome was very powerful and like capable of exerting enormous oppression over people. Like that was true, right? It's also true that Mike Flynn is a scumbag and that Mike Flynn is an expert in, you know, psychological warfare and disinformation and all this sort of thing. Right. That he is a fascist and that he is anti-democratic and that he is remarkably influential and has a giant platform and a ton of money. All those things are true. That doesn't make him Q. And it doesn't mean that you can like bully him and have him arrested for crimes he hasn't committed, because nothing he's done so far as we know, like, has been criminal. And certainly Jim Stewartson has not like blown the lid off of this guy, right? But it's exactly right. You don't, the fear of it being nobody, and like Q ultimately at this point is nobody. Q has entered into, has become a metastasized in so many different forms. It's almost like Protestant Christianity now, that it just sort of is whatever you want it to be. There isn't a Q, and it doesn't matter who it is, even if there was, right? It's that's not the point. But when you are so terrified of what it has done, and I think that's, you know, Jim Stewartson's right to be terrified of what it's done, but this isn't the fight and this isn't the battle, and that's not how you're going to win it, because that's not how it works. That's not how, you know, that's not how conspiracism works. It takes on a religious angle. It takes on a life of its own. It is in the eye of the believer, right? And that is what makes it so terrifying, because you can't really fight that. And you have to take much more complicated and nuanced approaches to it if you're going to, right? You can't be like, hey man, I know you're a Christian, but like we went to space and God's not there, so you should stop believing in that now, right? Like that's not going to work. That's, you know what I mean? Like,
sure. Yeah.
And it might have shocked someone several thousand years ago to be like, what do you mean God's not in space, right? But it's not going to work anymore, because that's not right. It's silly to think that anybody would be like, what? Yes. But I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's a really important point. Mike Flynn sucks. Well, that could be true.
And I think, honestly, it's easier. I think it's easier for us as human beings to compartmentalize things, to say that there is an enemy. And for Jim Stewartson, apparently, it's Michael Flynn. That's his guy. That's his nemesis. And, you know, that's who he focuses on. But the truth is actually scarier in the fact that Michael Flynn is just one guy. And there's many guys that are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, for sure. And
it's like, actually more frightening.
That's part of sort of the comfort of religion, right? Or at least especially religion through the Christian framework, is that there's this battle of good and evil that is like beyond your control, but like probably the good guy is going to win in the end. You just got to pick the right side, right? And like, And thinking of the reason why bad things happen is because of this force that we call evil, right? Like, yeah, of course that's comforting, because it makes you not have to think about the far more terrifying thought that like people do things for sometimes rational reasons, or sometimes reasons that are like have to do with brain chemistry and have to do with like the way that they were abused growing up, and all that sort of thing is really terrifying and difficult to grapple with. And like, of course it's appealing, right? And again, I think when we talk about why people become conspiracy theorists, I know you guys know this perfectly well, but like it has nothing to do with like how smart you are, right? I mean, neither does like joining a cult. It has everything to do with sort of emotional vulnerability. And also, you know, sometimes you're right. Sometimes there was a conspiracy, and that's happened too. So sometimes Rome really is out to get you, you know,
One of the things I found intriguing with Jim Stewartson, and I want to kind of get Kelly's thoughts on all this in just a second, but one of the things that I really found intriguing was when he contrasted the QAnon prayer that he did with the Elizabeth Clare Prophet's prayer. I thought that was incredibly interesting. And, you know, this is something that, you know, theosophy, we've talked a lot about the occult on this show.
Yeah.
And like that straight, I mean, ultimately you can draw that from, you know, her line of belief from the, through the IM movement, through theosophy. So I found that that was extremely interesting.
We're going to cover theosophy at some point that came up with Srina, and we're going to get there because I think we both are really interested in talking about it. But the thing about that, Adam, is like, that's because Mike Flynn's an idiot and someone gave him that prayer and said it was a Christian prayer. And he was like, oh, cool. And it sounds really
possible
up my alley. So I'm just going to like, that's the much better explanation of why that happened.
Or just cynical.
Yeah.
Cynical way. You know, it's not like there are,
but if you believe that Mike Flynn is this like deceptive mastermind who's into theosophy, then like, yeah, of course that's where you're going to go with it, right? Like, that's, even though that's probably not the best explanation of why
I think the tactic there, John, is to say that, okay, this Michael Flynn that purports himself to be this big Christian, he was at a church here in the area not that long ago, a few months ago. Okay, I know where this church is. Purports to be a big Christian. Jim Stewartson is trying to say, well, he's not. Right. He's actually into this new age philosophy. And that's the tactic that's normally used.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, but look, yeah, of course. But then, you know, I think he's also, like, he's a Catholic too. So, like, scripture wouldn't even be a thing that he cares about because Catholics famously don't care about scripture. Could be wrong about that. But, you know, it's also like...
be wrong about that.
Donald Trump... I could be wrong, but Donald Trump,
we can edit to
Second Corinthians as 2 Corinthians, right? So you can keep that in. Yes. That's fine. So yeah, I mean, yes, of course he's cynical. Of course he's full of shit. Like, absolutely. But it's like, I mean, Jim, like, people knew about that a long time ago. Like, yeah, it's not yeah, like
I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was
No, it is. Like, it definitely is really interesting. I'm blocked by Jim Stewartson, so I can't speak.
I'll send you screenshots.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, Kelly, I want to get your thoughts on some of this that we've been talking about.
Oh my gosh, it's been a whirlwind. Like, what?
How Christianity informs conspiracism.
Christianity informs conspiracism.
Gospel according to the plan, which we are going to have you back on to talk about more in depth. And so, I feel that, you know, the Klan, I mean, they thought.
Battle for good and evil.
Woodwork against them. Yeah.
The soul of the nation at stake, right? I mean, this is one of the things that I talk about in the book, and we can talk about more later, but you want to talk about folks that were convinced that they were locked in a battle of good and evil because they were going to be the people that were going to save white Christian America from everyone else was the Klan in the 1920s. And very much concerned about Catholics, right, who are going to take over, very much concerned about Rome and the Pope, right, having some sort of political power. But it's, you know, that they saw people out to get them everywhere, you know, threats in local government, threats in state government, national government, threats in their neighborhood, right? You can't trust folks who aren't white Christians in your neighborhood, right? So don't go to
specifically a deli. Protestant.
Right. Protestant. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Because Catholics wouldn't count, right, as Christian in their rendering. But I mean, it was just so much a part of how they understood themselves and walked around in their day to day that everybody is an enemy if you don't look like them and believe like them and act like them. And so much of that kind of conspiratorial mindset in that, and in that book in particular about who wasn't against them really is sort of the open question in that book. It's like, who did they not pick a fight with or have right. some kind of argument with?
And they picked those fights, so it's kind of like a
self-fulfilling prophecy. They did. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and that's the thing is the Klan in the 20s wanted to claim that they were both, you know, in charge of themselves and like on the front lines of this fight, but they also wanted to be the victims of everything. And I think that falls within that conspiratorial mind view too, right? Like that they very much want to say that they're in charge and on top. And then as soon as something goes wrong, they want to say that they're the victims, right? That somebody is out to get them and that you don't understand the powers that be are always monitoring them. They're always under some sort of watch. They're always being threatened. That very much out of the 1920s playbook. I mean, there's a really funny chapter in there about how they get into a fight with Notre Dame students, where they go to Notre Dame and then Notre Dame students actually come at them and they're not ready for it. It was one of my funnest chapters to write because it's just one of those things where it's like, what did you expect was going to happen when you went after college students? Like, did you not see that this was going to go wrong in some sort of way? But it just shows how like also unprepared they are for real like action. Like they're very good at the talking piece of this kind of stuff. They were not necessarily good at some of the follow through. So the rhetoric piece of what they're doing is pretty strong game, but sometimes the real life battles they didn't do so well in, especially now that in an internet culture where people are pretty tough mm-hmm. on the internet streets, but maybe not as tough.
You always have the conspiracy to blame for all your failures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's very much part there too of what they're doing is that when things went wrong, it's not because of them. It's always someone else to blame, right? That something has gone wrong. You can't take individual responsibility for it. And I feel like that definitely carries through to contemporary white supremacist far right movements as well. Everybody's to blame except for them, right?
With some of those contemporary movements, what kind of trends do you all think people should really pay attention to?
Yeah, so I'll just say that. So our episode that's probably going to be pretty concurrent with whenever this goes up. We talked to our buddy Brad Onishi about Christian nationalism from a bunch of different points of view. Yeah, it's very serious. I certainly have seen it get a lot worse in recent years. There has been a, you know, speaking of conspiracy theories, frankly, a conspiracy of far-right anti-democratic Christian nationalists over the last several decades. You know, and this ties directly into the John Birch Society and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. To put, you know, sort of anti-democratic Christian nationalists in positions of power in various institutions, and it is now. We're seeing the fruits of that labor. I'm very, very concerned. You know, I'm sure, you know, January 6th is something that you can look at from a bunch of different perspectives, but certainly one of them is as a uprising of Christian nationalism. Then you have to sort of, though, I think, you know, place that against the rise of, you know, the so-called nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S, not N-U-N-S. We need a different word for that, by the way, because we already have a religion word that's nuns, and like it's whatever. But the people who identify as no religion and no affiliation is rising steadily as well. And it's just really hard to sort of decide whether or not this is sort of a spasm of a time that we're dealing with or a trend towards something very dark and disturbing. But I think the way that you look at sort of like, I mean, you know, to be determined as to how kind of the next big election is going to factor in to this, but the fever of abortion bans across the country, right? is part of that fate. I don't think we've seen quite what the punchback is yet. And I think we'll know quite a bit more in 2024, but certainly nothing conclusive. But as you know, as our friend Megan Goodwin says, you know, religion's not over you, even if you're over religion. And as soon as you think you are, that's where you run into trouble. I don't know, Kelly, what would you say to that?
Yeah, I would say look to Florida, right? I feel like I'm living in the middle of a white Christian nationalist, just kind of legislative, oh, I don't even know what to call it. Legislative chaos. Yeah, I don't know. Theocracy. We had a legislative session that was particularly bad when it came to LGBTQ rights, with concerns over abortion bans also still there and still present, with Florida coming down pretty hard on that. We have DeSantis flirting with Nazi imagery right now, which is a current controversy, even though Stafford was fired, but that he's really kind of played out, our governor has really kind of played with these ideas and tested them out here. And so, you know, there's kind of chatter about, you know, is Florida a testing ground? I really hope not, you know, for a larger national campaign for these kinds of tactics. As someone who lives here, I hope that's not the case, right? I'm really hoping that we do get a lot of pushback and a lot of momentum and a lot of organizing. And there is organizing happening on the ground here against this kind of stuff. But I'm really kind of curious as to and what that's going to look like, since 2024 is not just around the corner. We're still moving through this election cycle that feels endless, but to see what that's going to kind of look like, I think is going to be one of our markers of what's going on with this white Christian nationalism and where it's moving from. Brad, who we had on, was somewhat optimistic, but not super optimistic. Yeah. Like he was more optimistic than I was, where I just kind of sighed protractively and laid on the floor. But like, I think that's something to pay attention to, that we have to take seriously, that there are already states that are testing this stuff out, right? And legislative sessions that have already like veered in directions that are dangerous and that are targeting certain people, so that we have to pay attention to that.
You know, Surfiel today, he sent me a article. Well, it actually was a video Democracy Now! Did on these. I think the state of Indiana is trying, or it might be the other way around. I think people from Kentucky are going to Indiana to get abortions.
Yeah.
And that they're seeking out basically the names of these people from Kentucky.
Yeah.
That if you cross the state line and you go get a woman gets an abortion in Indiana, then she gets still, the implication there is that these people, these attorney generals looking at this, could possibly prosecute them for murder.
Yeah.
And this is something
that
I responded to him that is analogous to something like the Fugitive Slave Act, in which part of the compromise of 1850, in which the, basically, it said that, you know, slaves were okay if they crossed the Ohio River or the Mason-Dixon line, but after the Fugitive Slave Act, which is part of the compromise, they could send slave hunters to go and pick these people up in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that was the road to the Civil War right there. I mean, that was essentially that reminded me of that. So, I mean, there is room for concern here, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, there's lots of room for concern. And like one of those, I think one of those sort of reasonable assumptions is that we are heading towards a civil war, or that we're in one right now. And it just looks very different from, you know, boys in the battlefield of, you know, the 19th century, because obviously we're not going to have that kind of civil war. I also like the thing that I would also sort of urge people to consider is that you know, one of the ways that sort of conspiratorial thinking and even religious thinking sort of trains us to do is assume that there's going to be a point where everything's fine now, where the good guys do win, and then we move on into the sunset and I'll just live happily ever after. And that's just not how history works. And that's just not how humanity works. We are always going to be fighting against the forces of like anti-democratic theocrats. It is never going to end. It's just sort of like, how much influence do you have at any given time, right? Is the question. And I think one of the things that kind of got us here is a kind of a complacency among people to say, like, you know, well, they're never coming back, and we are, that's not who we are anymore, and it's the 21st century, and we're all good now. And we really, I mean, there are people, I think, like me and Kelly, who've been like screaming about like, no, they're very much there, and they very much want to bring us back to the 17th century. But, you know, when you look at liberals who were surprised that the court overturned Roe, and I'm like, what? How the fuck were you surprised by that? It's, yeah. You know, I think it's really important to take from what's happening right now as a lesson to say, we are going to be fighting for people's rights forever. There is not going to be a time where people aren't going to try to take them away. We are in a dark part of that fight right now. But we always... There isn't a storm. There isn't a great awakening. It's not going to happen, right? We have to fight forever, and it's just a we are several steps back right now.
Well, I think it's a constant process. I mean, since the Civil War, the first one, I think it has been a constant. You know, step. It has been a constant progress, and that's just how it's been. To kind of address the idea of how, what form a civil war would take. I mean, I honestly think, in my opinion, and I've said this before on the show, that I feel like it'll be like Northern Ireland.
Insurgents
model.
I think that's a reasonable thing to think. But also, I mean, Northern Ireland didn't have the internet, and I think there's an information part of it that is different now in terms of the way that we win battles, and that you win ideologically and you win informationally, and that's the one thing that maybe Alex Jones has been right about, that we are in an information war, and
I feel like the right is winning that. I really do.
Oh, they definitely are.
Well, they have religion on their more on their side, and I think that's a big part of it. It's mythopoetic, you know. It's like it's hard to win against folks like that with like rationalism and secularism.
And the right dumped and lost billions and billions of dollars into right wing radio over the last several decades for that purpose. They knew it was a losing, it wasn't a profitable enterprise, but this is what they got from it, right? And like the left didn't, we had Air America for like 5 years or whatever. Like, look how well that went, you know?
I mean, Serfio, he lived in Nashville for a long time. He's in the Seattle area now. So Kelly and I are in the South. John, you're in Massachusetts.
Yeah, where it's safe.
What's the difference that you feel regionally? Do you feel like you just said, John, do you feel like you're safer in Massachusetts than you would be in Tennessee or Florida? And Serviel, you know, do you feel you're safer in Washington? I mean, you know, like, you know, it feels very much like the regionally, it is still...
Yeah, it's not North and South anymore either, right? And that's another reason why there won't be a kind of clean civil war ever again, I don't think. It is incredibly sort of, you know, balkanized in how these sort of ideological pockets, right, sort of exist. And then also in like, you know, like efforts by the right to occupy certain states. Right. I mean, like the story of Idaho in the last decade or so. Right. It's sort of part of that story. Yeah. I always sort of jokingly think of New England as like its own sort of, you know, independent state, free from the insanity of the rest of the country. But
well, yeah, if the Hartford Convention had succeeded, you know, what happened?
Yeah. You know, it's not always true. It's not just like everybody here isn't just like a bright blue, you know, leftist. And I haven't seen anything that concerns me structurally, right, about sort of this region. But certainly, like, if there's another Trump administration, yeah, I think it's, I don't think with, you know, Trump without handcuffs, so to speak, is who knows what could happen. States and regions only have so much autonomy at the end of the day. And again, it's sort of, I'm trying to live in now as much as possible and not terrify myself about the future too much, but it can be hard to do sometimes.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you that Trump and handcuffs, that will be the insurgency. That's what I'm most. Oh,
well, Trump and literal handcuffs. Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Which brings us to the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Naturally.
So, Kelly, I wanted to ask you about your book that you wrote about the concept of zombie apocalypse and how it kind of reflects American culture in a lot of ways.
So I was interested in writing about people that believed in the zombie apocalypse and thinking through what that might mean about American culture, particularly about violence in American culture. And unsurprisingly, when I got into it, it was folks who imagined that the only way the world was going to get better is for the world to get worse and be destroyed. And then maybe if we started over, it would be better. Maybe not, but at least we would have zombies, and zombies are fun. Right. So it's a book about folks who are sort of hoping for that violent end with zombies, that they are really looking forward to that moment when the zombie apocalypse occurs. You finally get to have your guns out. You get to use those survival skills. You get to do this kind of stuff. Doesn't matter if you're not trained. Doesn't matter if you don't know what you're doing. Right. But it's that like glorified fantasy that you have, that you could rock the zombie apocalypse if you had this chance, right? And that our world is so broken and so not worthwhile that this will be our chance to actually like live some sort of glorious future in the ruins or something like that. It's a wild project that really got me thinking about the ethics of violence and why in the world people really wanted zombies to happen so desperately. And of course, then you get down the rabbit hole of people that believe that the CDC knows that zombies are happening, right? Or that there's somehow footage of zombies that have already occurred, or, you know, that there's some sort of something somewhere in some lab, right, that could do this. Or it's the little ants whose brains have been inhabited by a fungus that'll eventually transfer to humans, right? Bing, bing, bang. And then we'll have zombies, and this is how it'll happen. It was an interesting project to get into that and to kind of work through why Americans love the end of the world so much and what that says about us, right? That we would rather hit the like awful like end restart button then we would actually like to work towards collective change together.
Is the essence of a lot of that like a dehumanization?
The other? One of the things that I talk about is who becomes zombies,
right,
most commonly in these scenarios, and who people actually want to kill. So yeah, a lot of the book
is about wholesale, you know, slaughter.
Yeah.
No longer human, and you can just unleash violence.
And then you can do whatever you want to, right, if they're no longer human. And so, yeah, so I have a whole chapter on like America and guns, right, and like how guns are tied to wholesale destruction. I started writing pieces of it a few years after Newtown and the mass shooting there. And then unsurprisingly, just after the series of school shootings, I mean, it's kind of endless, right? That you could kind of comment on this, partially because one of the things that I did is I watched a documentary on zombie doomsday preppers, which is a real thing, folks that are explicitly prepping for zombie doomsday. And they were talking about how they would like shoot their kids in the face if they turned into zombies. And I was just like, whoop, time out, right? Like something's going on here if this is how we'll talk, right? Or if this is how we think, or if we have no problem taking these people that are supposed to be super precious to us, right? And that they could become that dehumanized, that we wouldn't have a problem like talking about them in this way or even acting in this way. So yeah, so as a project, it's all about how we other people and how we dehumanize them and what that allows us to get away with and why people want to fantasize about that, right? As the ethics piece for me, as I was like, why do we want to think in these ways? What does it tell us about our culture? Nothing really nice, right? It's not a happy book. I don't write happy books, but like, it's not a happy book. So, yeah.
Wow. I was exposed a little bit because, you know, I was a huge Walking Dead fan. I love mm-hmm. The Walking yeah. Dead, you know, I mean, not so much the later years. I finished it. I waited till it was on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And I was familiar with that fandom. And it is really a very kind of rural based kind of fandom, very kind of conservative fandom. It's very similar in a lot of ways to things that Surfiel and I have noticed about the Bigfoot community.
Oh, interesting.
That's a whole other thing. I mean, people, a lot of really kind of right-wing rural people have adopted Bigfoot as this interesting symbol. But I did notice that this was a thing, but I didn't really think anything of it. I mean, I guess people always take things to extremes. But I mean, I remember Alex echoing some of this because I used to listen to Alex Jones a lot. And I remember Alex Jones echoed the whole idea of the zombie apocalypse, that the people in the cities, when they run out of drugs, they're going to come after you and they're going to come to the rural areas and they're going to come get your shit. And that's basically... That was the kind of stuff that he would harp on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right in a lot of ways. And Walking Dead actually did something very clever in one of their episodes. There was an episode, it was in the middle of the fifth season, and they did an episode where there was this blur between what was going on the show and what in reality. And they had Andrew Lincoln, who played Rick in the show. He's actually, you can hear these radio broadcasts that this character that is dying is hallucinating and listening to. And he is hearing these things where he's talking about killing these people, this mass genocide, and all this, as if what is happening in The Walking Dead wasn't actually happening. That it was this psychosis that was going on and they were actually killing living people and they were actually committing genocide.
Right.
And I thought that was an interesting technique that they used in that episode.
Yeah. They did some interesting things. We talked about The Walking Dead a little bit when we talked about The Last of Us and, you know, addressed some of these points as well. And actually, like, one thing that Kelly said there, I think is also important, speaking of Alex Jones, is that Alex Jones quite recently, actually, I think said that he was prepared to murder his own children rather than hand them over to the New World Order. You should do the same, like be prepared to murder your children because that's the courageous thing to do and not let the New World Order have them. Right. And just like swap out zombies and that's that. Right. And it's this nameless, faceless, you know, entity that's coming for you and never seems to get around to it. But yeah, it's a terrifying sort of militant ideology that it tends to breed, which is why I think like The Last of Us is interesting because it tries to center itself around humanity so much more, right? And ask some pretty interesting questions about like how people really would operate, that I think The Walking Dead takes a much more sort of bleak, sort of nihilistic view of. But all that's all religion.
That was and of course you guys talked about this in one of your episodes, that there was the religion episode The Last of Us.
Yeah.
I don't play video games, so I wasn't familiar with the video game.
Yeah, us either.
I thought that The Last of Us was a really good take on what something could more realistically look like.
Yeah.
Because at least in The Last of Us, like in Walking Dead, society has completely collapsed. In Walking Dead,
so fast.
In The Last of Us, there's still authority.
Yeah.
It's still there.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know, it's in pockets, but it's still pretty much there. And I thought that was an interesting concept, and that people were more, it was a little more, I think you guys are right, a little more realistic in a way.
Yeah.
But that's fascinating about that, about the zombie apocalypse idea.
Yeah. Our running joke at my house is like how quickly the zombie apocalypse like destroys everything, right? Like that it's just super sudden, that like people just fall apart, you know, pretty quickly. Yeah. And then there are no spoons for some reason. No one can find spoons anywhere in any of these like films. So
I made this joke.
All the silverware vanishes for some reason. I don't know why, but like it's gone.
I mean, we got to resort to eating pudding with our fingers, like Ron.
We do. Yeah. That's what happens.
What do you think the appeal is of that concept for a lot of?
I think a lot of people sort of imagine that they're going to be the hero in the story. That they really think that what's going to happen is that they're suddenly going to learn how to use a gun. They're suddenly going to be able to identify which plant that they can eat. That they're going to be able to render gasoline from pig fat or something like this, right? That they're just going to magically get these skills, and then they're going to be the ones that like survive in this apocalyptic scenario where there are so many people gone and it's a new West, right?
They're going to be on top.
Go out and conquer. They're going to be on top, right? Like they're going to do it. And I think that that's part of the like longstanding appeal, is that you're going to finally be the one in charge, right? And you're in charge of your destiny, and you don't work anymore, and you don't have to answer to a boss, and you don't have to deal with all these other sorts of things, right? I watch enough of this stuff that I know that like I'm like a middle-aged white lady who is also a feminist who has two loud kids. Like I know I'm going, right? Like it's just gonna happen. Like I'm gone like super quick, right? Like first like scene, like it's not gonna work. But I think for a lot of people that they've just kind of imagined this like glory days that they're gonna have ahead of them, and that's how it's gonna work out. And I just think that realistically that's not the way it works, but like the fantasy of that, right, is a lot of fun. And that's what I found with my book, is that there are a lot of people that the fantasy is a lot of fun, and that people spend a lot of money prepping for that too.
Did you interview some of these people? Did you like?
So I didn't do, I did a little bit of interviewing. I did a lot of like just researching and checking out what people were doing. So tiny bit of interviewing. I really thought at some point that I was going to do like a prepper's weekend sort of thing. And then I remembered that like, I don't like the outdoors and I can't run. And so it was not worth my while to like keep up with doomsday preppers as they like got dropped off in the woods somewhere and this sort of thing. No, I think if I did it over, I would do more interviews, but I didn't spend a ton of time with doomsday preppers for lots of reasons.
As a popular culture motif, do you feel that the zombie apocalypse has kind of run its course? Because I definitely, you know? When The Last of Us came out, I was like, oh my God.
So this is the deal.
But I gave it a chance.
This is the deal. I always think we have to be done. Like, right? Like Disney has made movies about zombies, right? Like it has to be over at this point if Disney has made movies about zombies. And then like something else pops up that actually kind of works. Cause I felt the same way about The Last of Us, where I was like, come on, like one more thing, like one more thing, like it can't be real. And then I was like, damn it, it's actually good. Right. Like, and yeah. I watched all of it and I liked it. So I would hope that it's like run its course, but I'm always wrong about this. There always seems to be something that pops, like you can't get rid of this genre. Like it won't go away. For
like auto-tune sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? I mean, Adam, like I think, you know, part of it is the question that you asked about the appeal, right? I think it is just endlessly appealing that there's something like profoundly kind of gratifying about this narrative. You know, I think about to like the you know, giant meteor 2016 bumper stickers of people who were like, neither Trump nor Hillary Clinton, just a giant meteor. And of course that's sarcastic and everything, but it's not entirely sarcastic. Like there's something about it of this desire for it's kind of rooted in the same as like the fantasy of Make America Great Again, right? Where it's sort of like you're not saying when again is or what it looks like. You just sort of know that there was this like time when things were different and men were men and could like protect the children and be the heroes and the action heroes and everything else. And also like there weren't like cell phones and like Barbie movies everywhere. And so, you know, if it takes a meteor or zombies to make that happen, then great. I mean, there's something about that narrative where there's a lot to it, but I think the appeal is similar to that, like taking your desk and just like shoving everything off of it sort of thing, or like burning your house down because it's messy, right? That sort of same kind of fantasy. And again, I think this is very rooted in the way that we think about sort of the way that religious narratives play out, right? That the idea of like the New Jerusalem, the idea of the apocalypse, it is immensely, even if it requires a lot of turmoil and death and destruction, right? It's immensely satisfying because it's not this shit. And like that, I think is part of why it's so appealing, that there's something about the kind of utopian fantasy that we instinctively know isn't real. And so the different world has to be sort of gritty and violent, but in some ways it's like it gets us back to our like, you know, natural,
noble,
whatever.
Yeah.
Same with Game of Thrones, right? It's the similar sort of thing. It's like watching that sort of gritty, violent, like pre-technology world has that same kind of appeal to it. It's it makes us think how much, you know, sort of how static and kind of, you know, disconnected we feel like we've become,
sit these people down, people that want the zombie apocalypse, make them watch two movies, make them watch Threads,
yeah,
and make them watch The Road. And I think it might
be The Road is a great idea. That's a good one.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I don't know if you
we'll take Threads. Our enormous sway in Hollywood and make sure that
these are two movies that I will never watch again, but are incredibly impactful.
So, absolutely. Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah. Anybody that likes the fantasy of the apocalypse, like, I feel like you should just hand them a copy of The Road, right? Like, just be like, here.
Right.
Good luck. You won't anymore.
RIP Cormac McCarthy.
Well, whenever, you know, everybody was talking about the new social media thing, Threads, my PTSD flared.
Threads.
I hate it so much.
Have you ever seen that movie? Sergio, you ever seen that?
No.
I
haven't either, and I'm just going to skip. I'm just going to pass.
It's, Vladimir Putin needs to watch it. So, guys, this has been incredible. I really have enjoyed you guys being on.
Thanks for having us.
And,
we appreciate it.
Thank you for coming on. Please tell us where we can find Pod Only Knows and where we can find you guys. And Kelly, we will start with you.
Pod Only Knows, you can find where you find other podcasts. That's right, John. Yes. That's what I can say on Apple.
Look for Pod Only Knows.
Look for Pod Only Knows. You can find, you can find me on what used to be Twitter, but I'm not calling it anything else. I'm not calling it that.
No, never call it. Well, that's our show policy. We're never fucking calling it X. Never
calling it X.
Until it dies. Yeah.
Yeah. So on when I'm still calling Twitter, at Kelly underscore J underscore Baker. And let's see, you can also find me on a variety of other social media with that same handle. So I think that's also my Threads handle, where I'm we're trying in this like Twitterless world to like get along. So that's where you can find me. And then on Blue Sky, my handle is Kelly J. Baker. So if you're happen to be over there too, I'm spending some time there trying to figure out that ecosystem as well. In the age of 30 million Twitter impersonators, you can find me on some.
Where can everyone find your books?
Oh, right,
we should mention that.
Okay. Yeah. So you can find my books on, if you like big corporations, on Amazon. And if you want to shop more local, bookshop.org. So you can find them on either of those spaces.
Awesome.
All right, John, you're up.
We should add, though, too, that Kelly will be coming on in a few episodes to talk about her book, Gospel According to the Klan. So Serfiel and I will be digging into that book, and
we'll
be talking to her about that. So. And John, where can people find you?
I am on the artist formerly known as Twitter at probably real JB. That's all one word. I'm trying to spend more time just on Blue Sky. I'm there just at John Brooks. That's my handle. You can find me there if you're on Blue Sky, and if you're not, then I just gave out two invitations, so next time I get some, let me know, and I'll give you an invitation to Blue Sky, because I'm trying to get everybody over there, because it's a weird and kind of stupid place, and but there's less Nazis, so it has it going for it there. And both of you, by the way, I've over the last, you know, several appearances on this show, come to realize that you both have some pretty interesting stories to tell about your own religious journeys. So you should come on our show at some point and talk about them. We'd love to hear.
Yeah, anytime.
Love to hear your thoughts. You know, I learned quite a bit about Adam today. So
yeah, I really wanted to start putting ourselves and our stories out there too.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, it's great. Really enjoyed it.
I will be interviewing Serfiel next week.
Thanks, Serfiel, guys.
Thank you. You can tell us, everybody, where they can find our Patreon, and they can see John's excellent presentation.
Yes. If you join the Mystic Crew of Conspiranormal at the $10 pledge level, you can see John's presentation, as well as a pretty good catalog of other presentations as well that we try to do every month. I think we're skipping it this month. Got a lot of planning ahead for the larger Strange Realities conference, but we try to have those monthly Strange Realities streaming events as much as possible. You can go over to patreon.com/conspiranormal to find out more about that.
All right, guys, we will go ahead and close out the show. Thank you so much for listening. Just a couple of announcements. Strange Realities conference is coming up November 3rd through the 5th, November 3rd through the 4th in Nashville, Tennessee, and November 5th online. I want you guys to come to Nashville, enjoy, and be a part of that. If you can't, come be a part of it online. And also, as part of the Strange Realities family, Nevaeh's Nightmare YouTube channel. Check that out as well. And guys, we will be back next week. I'm going to interview Serfiel on Conspiranormal.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.